Right, now, just if anyone on the speakers, if any of the speakers wishes just to do a quick sort of 30-second summary of what they've said, either to correct false impressions given by later speakers about what they said, or this morning, but I'm good. We'll do that now. So, you can.
So I'd like to start off by saying that Jonathan, in his talk, suggested that I was arguing for truth as a social value. And if that's the impression I've given you, then I'm sorry for not making myself clear, because actually I'm arguing for the opposite scenario. I'm saying if we think of truth as just having a social value, then that is where we run into all these problems that might ultimately suck us into getting caught into that net of being falsely accused. I'm not sure whether I want to say that truth is a value, but certainly I want to say that truth has a value in a sense, that it's truth that matters, not any sort of preference or self-interest values, truth itself, that we need to get to. And then, if I may just say a few things, because I want to pick up on some things that Peter said. And that's before I started working on this paper, I used to sort of take a Morian sort of view in thinking about truth, in the idea that saying that it's false that I'm standing up is contingently true, that I'm sitting down. When Peter presented me with this idea of truth makers, I thought, this gives us a different way to think about truth. Because the problem I find with that idea of contingent truth is it just doesn't seem to be how we go about things in the world. It only occurs to philosophers that there are these contingent truths, that we might be dreaming things. We don't behave like that. We behave more in the way that Peter describes, with this idea of truth makers. And I think, as I've come to think about the ideas that have been presented, I think there are two truth makers. There's one which is a truth maker, as Peter says, that is a fact about the world. And there are another that are truth makers that come from ourselves through the process of reflection that I talked about that Descartes lays out, but that way we can get to a truth maker. What I would say, though, is that we don't have truth makers of other people's minds. We don't get to that. And that then brings us into things that Eileen was saying, but I'll stop there because I've said quite a bit already.
Okay. Well, I want to, first of all, I've made a number of distinctions. One is between fact and the way the world works, or the way the world is. Fact is part of the way the world is, but the way the world is includes the way it could possibly be, the patterns of the world by which we understand it. I wanted to prioritize way of understanding over truth, because truth is an absolute bivalent on-off ideal, whereas the way of understanding is something we use all the time, based on induced patterns, regularities, natural law, all those things. It's not only a way of understanding, it's also one of them. We have many ways of understanding. We have alternative ways of understanding. Many models appropriate to different levels of understanding for different phenomena. And it's important that we should be able to pick those up and put them down, not to say that any one is true. For example, reductionism is a failure to understand that there is more than one way of understanding phenomena or the world or ourselves and so forth. Many ways of understanding are insightful, useful. You could say they're illusions, but that doesn't matter, because if they're useful, you pick them up, use them for the purpose, put them down again. But they're not delusions. Delusions are destructive and illusions are instructive. I think that's all I can say for the moment.
Okay. Jonathan, you want to say, give your minute summary, if you'd like, and then I'll go on to the questions.
Well, I don't really want to give a minute summary, because I think if I didn't get it across when I was speaking, then I'm not going to do it now. But just a couple of quickies about the other two. Because first of all, apologies to Fazio, I didn't mean by social value expedience or pragmatism. I meant, I was trying to refer to what she referred to as our moral responsibility towards each other. And that's what the social value that I thought she was espousing about truthfulness. Secondly, a point about history and fiction. History as being something about facts. I'm actually primarily a historian, that's my excuse, and I got into history by reading historical fiction that awoken my interest, and my test of good history in terms of an explanation is still, does this ring as true as a good piece of fiction?
Right, with our questions, it's the usual thing, if you put your hand up and you catch my eye, then I will take your question. Right, I'll start. Keep your hand up until I've caught your eye. Stuart, you were left off the last list, so I'll ask you first. But have others keep your hand up, please.
I can't.
It's a question for Peter Gibson regarding the truth makings. I noticed that you said that when I am sitting in this chair, it is a truth that, in a way, I felt was irrefutable. But there were some experiments done with people under the influence of LSD. One was the one where the man was absolutely firmly convinced, although he was sitting in the middle of the floor, that he was being absorbed by a wall. And when that wall absorbed him, he would be shut down. And there was medical research that showed that people who were in this condition actually did shut down. I just wondered, if we're talking about that, the truth was in that person's mind, and that took them on to a different level, and how would you apply that to the truth makers?
Well, on the whole, I'm defending a pretty robust theory of truth, and I'm taking it as just not true that this guy was being absorbed into the wall. But, I mean, if you wanted to say something like, actually, I'm completely wrong about truth, and truth is sort of a highly relative thing, you know, sort of how you see the world is your truth, or something like that, it wouldn't necessarily mean that I would give up on truth makers. I would still say, well, supposing it's true for him that he's being absorbed into the wall, then I'd still want to say, well, what's the truth maker for him for that? And it's presumably some sort of hallucination or some sort of weird thing going on inside his mind. So for most of us, if you're being absorbed in a wall, the truth maker is to do with walls and your body going into them. But in that theory, the truth maker would become an internal thing to the mind. But I think my theory would survive this rather odd state of affairs.
Anyone else like to flip it? Okay.
Sorry. I'm a bit unhappy with that view, because it makes truth something, it leaves open the possibility. I'll start again. I don't like the idea that there exists a truth maker for this delusion that one is being absorbed into a wall. There is no truth maker for that. And the guy who is hallucinating is under a delusion, and that's it. There's no truth maker for it. He's not being absorbed into a wall. And the idea of a truth that only you know doesn't really make sense to me. It makes truth relative, and I don't think we want that.
comment. In my talk, I just left it open that there can be all sorts of views about what the truth makers are. I think I had a little list at the beginning, something like, you know, if you thought all truths emanated from the mind of God, then the mind of God and the thoughts of God would be your one mega truth maker. That's not my theory, but if it was your theory, then the theory of truth makers would still apply to it. And so it's supposed to embrace all kinds of weird things about people who listen.
Okay, you know. So what you're suggesting is that you can, that any weirdo can have a truth maker theory. And in fact, I think I'm going to have to accept that.
Only sensible people have the truth
I do take your point, so I now understand your response to Stuart, but I wouldn't want to go along with that, really.
I think there's just a good, one of the points about truth makers that you made was that there are that they are the grounds of a belief.
Yes.
And I think one goes that far. Of any belief. No, there are grounds for it.
Of the truth.
And your chap who thinks he's being absorbed into a wall may not have a truth maker because it isn't actually true, but he does have grounds for his belief. And I don't see much point in going much further than the idea of grounds for what you think is true.
I'm not identifying grounds with truth makers, because obviously you can have rather flimsy grounds for a rather flimsy belief, which is not true. A truth maker, it's more like a verb. A truth maker grounds its truth, but there's more to truth making than mere grounding.
So, Peter, I thought you were coming up with the idea of primitive truth makers and then a hierarchy of truth makers on top of that.
Well, I'm nervous about the hierarchy because Frank.
Yeah, I'm nervous about the hierarchy.
I'll get back to you on that.
So, if we think about it, the way I'm thinking about your primitive truth makers is that I can say it is true that Peter is sitting next to me. What makes that true is my actual experience of Peter sitting next to me. Now, Peter Gibson gave us yesterday the idea of Marianne being in Scotland. How do I know if that's true? Well, I don't. Peter might have told me Marianne's in Scotland, but I don't actually know that that's true. So I don't have a truth maker for that. And this is then when we get on to inferences there. I know that it is true that Peter Thompson is sitting next to me. Peter Thompson, sorry. Got that straight about me. I know that it's true that Peter is sitting next to me. Therefore, I'm justified in claiming that Peter is not in Scotland. I know that because my truth maker is that Peter is sitting here next to me now. I don't know whether Marianne is in Scotland or in Oxford. I cannot make any reasonable inference about that. Even if I know that Marianne's not in Oxford, I can't then say that it's true that Marianne's in Scotland. I simply don't know that. So that's where I think the primitive truth makers are. She'll know where she is. She's got the primitive truth
maker. I just want to keep a clear distinction, partly and long, between my theory, which is about truth and the relationship of the truth makers, and the epistemology of it, which is what Fawzi is talking about, because ontology and epistemology are entirely distinct.
There's a dimension here that I find interesting that we maybe haven't dealt with very much over the weekend, and that is the story of truth. Bernard Williams warns against looking to try to define truth and say what it is. He says it's more interesting and potentially more productive if we look at the genealogy of truth and where it came from. We are people who set a high value on truth as a society and as individuals, And why should that be? How did it happen? My phone sometimes switches on podcasts at random, and it did so last night. And I actually wanted to explain what he knew of the behavior of cuckoos and their unwilling hosts. The cuckoo has the job of practicing deceit, and the host has the job of discerning truth. So reed warblers, the mum comes home to a nest and scrutinizes the eggs to see if they are all truly hers. And the cuckoo has the job of making sure that her egg looks sufficiently like a reed warbler's egg to deceive the reed warbler. So there has been an evolutionary battle between deceit and truth. And in that particular case, and even more so in the case of the development of human and culture and genetic endowment. So we are folk who, we're a social species, we can exchange information because we develop language uniquely, and that information we use to flourish. And if the information is accurate, it'll be useful. And so we place a high value on the accuracy of information. And because we obtain most of our information, according to Williams, by sharing, we can't always go back to the source. We've got to trust people. And so trustworthiness becomes an important character that we've got to judge effectively in the people we deal with. So these two virtues that Williams defines, accuracy in information and sincerity in people, are the twin characters of truth that are really interesting and worth exploring. So, does anybody have any comments on that?
Right. Quickly, yes, I think we're in an evolutionary battle with the Daily Mail at the moment. yes, trustworthiness and accuracy. Trustworthiness, certainly, because the source, we're always interested in sources, even academically, we print them, we put footnotes in, stuff like that, news items, we're constantly on the search for trustworthiness. Accuracy is different, because we can be apply different standards of accuracy to different kinds of information, different levels of information, and even to different sources. If somebody close to us, somebody we trust, says, well, I just feel it's wrong, that's not accurate, but we trust it. But whereas a piece of scientific information, the reading of an instrument, or the speedometer on our car, things like that, or a navigational aid, accuracy is absolutely vital. So I think when you don't apply accuracy, you apply a greater standard of accuracy to Hilary Mantel than you do to Terry Pratchett. But they're both fiction, and you can learn from both of them. I just think we apply those two things rather differently.
I'd just like to comment on what Hugh said by saying how incredibly interesting it was. So thanks to him and Bernard Williams, I think. Just the thought that started to float through my mind is, accuracy of information and sincerity, could you actually dispense with the notion of truth? That would be quite a good result of this weekend. And by just talking about accuracy of information and sincerity of pronouncements, and interesting.
Well, that sort of ties into the point that I think I was putting across with the reading of Rorty, is that he would argue that actually, on the grounds that truth actually just confuses the situation, that things like accuracy of information, interpretability, you know what I'm trying to say, which is that sort of conveyance of information and the making sense of experience are the important things. And when Peter this morning said that understanding trumps truth, so I was sort of going, you know, in my mind, yeah, I think that's the point. Truth obscures the issue because it is tied in with too many metaphysical notions that aren't clear. I was out walking this morning, as I often do when I'm in Oxford, trying to pick up the spirit of Strawson and people like that walking around. And I looked up at Carfax Tower, and there it is, Fortis Asperitus. So somebody around here knows what truth is, because they predicate that it is strong. So that's right. But they only had the idea that they could predicate something of truth because they held on to an idea of truth that was assumed from a Platonic vocabulary and tied in with a commitment to a world, I think, that was probably more stable perhaps than ours is, in their view. I mean, I'm not saying the world historically was stable, but in that Christian orthodoxy.
Orthodoxies
are important. But anyway, yes.
Thanks. The example that you gave of cuckoos suggests obviously that both deception and truthfulness, or the ability to discern deception, are part of the game, evolutionarily, and fair enough. If that was all the case, then the obvious outcome would be that the ideal outcome would be that I can detect whether other people are telling the truth, but nobody can tell that about me. In fact, we do seem to end up with putting a higher value on truth than that self-interested one, as Fauzia said.
Yeah. The evolution story again. We are, well, as animals, it is advantageous for us to be able to know what is the case and what is not the case. And I think primitive organisms have a just sort of either or switch on system. And as you climb up the scale, you get gradually more discriminating abilities. But I think without that ability to distinguish between what is the case and what is not the case, regardless of all the moral kind of trappings that you can put on top of that, you wouldn't survive as a species. Okay.
To add to that, A. Whitehouse is credited with having said in New York, somebody said, the ability to say there is a spider on that table is what distinguishes human beings from the beast. This is presumably going on into the idea of intentionality. Whitehouse said, no, the uniquely human ability is that of saying there is not a spider on that table. And therefore, I would disagree with Ali that animals have the ability to distinguish between what is the case and what is not the case. The animal kingdom has no idea about what is not the case. It is completely irrelevant to them. And I developed yesterday very rapidly a theory of truth, which is what I call the default theory of truth. You strip out all falsity, all error, all lies, you're left with the truth. And it doesn't have to be said. In fact, it's probably better if nobody states it, because then you know no doubt at all what the truth is.
that just ties in with something I was thinking just as the conversation was going on, is that actually what's more important is the recognition of deception. So it's almost as if truth is the negation of deception. In other words, it's sort of like negative dialectic, if you like, that there's an idea of it, which sort of possibly leads me to think of something that Peter was saying about useful myths. And then it sort of occurred to me during his talk that maybe truth is a useful myth, which seems slightly semantically paradoxical.
Yes.
I haven't really thought that through. They're just sort of like off the cuff thoughts.
Now,
may I?
Yes, very quick.
I just disagree that animals have no sense of negation. Obviously they don't go around using not and speculating about what's missing around here, but they clearly have a sense of absence, you know, when a partner dies or the nest has disappeared or something like that, it could easily be spelled out in negative terms. I think animals Now the head's full of what's missing as well as what's there.
And where's my milk? The same as what is
yes.
not true.
Now, now we've got 33 minutes left, and I've got 7 questions down here, which is approximately 5 minutes each, so I'm going to allow 5 minutes for the entire question and all the answers to it. And I'm going to be really strict. right. Next on my list is Mike.
First, a brief comment which I can't resist. A Czech philosopher many years ago said, truth does not win. Truth is merely what is left when everything else is squandered, which I think is a deep truth. But what I really wanted to ask, opinion from the panel really, and I know that some of you will agree with what I'm going to say, some will disagree. Some, for example, will probably agree, others probably will disagree. Whenever philosophers talk about truth, they almost invariably mention logic. The interesting thing about that is that logic, to my mind, has nothing to do with truth. Logic is a means of transmission of truth from premises to conclusions. And therefore, logic really is about fidelity, not about truth. And we often mistake the bivalence of this fidelity, it's either valid or not valid, for bivalence of truth, whereas truth is not bivalent. Like Isaac Asimov said to somebody, people used to think that the Earth is flat, and then they thought that Earth is round. They were both wrong. But if you think that they are equally wrong, then you are wronger than both of them together. Now, I would like comments from members of the panel. Why do they think that logic does or does not apply to the question of truth?
I can see no reason at all why it should.
I thought you were saying. Yeah, I sort of hold the centre of view there.
Well, I understand it as governing the conventions of the language, whether it be formal or lateral language that we use to discuss the things that we're talking about in order to ascertain truth or not truth. But, of course, it's not a reflection of the reality. It's not truth. The truth doesn't exist in the world. Truth exists in the statements that are made.
I would say that there are two different views of logic going around, and you can choose between them. There's a very austere syntactic view of logic that's sort of implementable on computers, to which truth is hardly relevant. I mean, you can attach some noughts and ones to it, but they don't mean anything. Or you can have a more full-blown notion in which you define logic as the rules for the preservation of truth. I mean, you're saying something like, well, there aren't any proper truths, so you can't do that. But it's a sort of hypothetical thing. And that sort of classical logic is designed for mathematics. And if you say very specifically, this is true, then logic preserves the truth, and you can draw inferences. And I prefer that second one. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, logic as the system for preserving truth seems to me the best way to understand it. So I wouldn't want to divorce truth from logic.
Nor should I. I accept Mike's point that logic operates merely as a means of transferring validity from premises to conclusions, but that seems to be a valuable part of the process of argument, of finding out what happened. Of if the premises are valid, then part of the truth making, the truth finding process is the proper inferences that may or may not be drawn from those premises. It still remains true that the whole thing depends upon the validity of the premises.
It's the truth of the premises, not the validity of the premises. The validity applies to the argument.
Fair enough. Yep.
But I mean, basically, I agree in principle with what both these guys have said. Logic is a tool. We make up logics, after all. So, you know, logic isn't something that's found out there in the world. There are patterns, as Peter said, and logic is just a useful pattern from that helps us understand the world and tracks the truth. Okay.
Yes, I agree that logic is useful in a way. Simon makes a statement, truth doesn't exist in the world. Then you've got that epistemological thing that's going on. Is that statement true or not? So we're looking then at how we're getting to whether that's true, because clearly if it is true, then it has very different implications.
I would say that truth isn't in the world, but I wouldn't be using the notion of truth. I would be avoiding that because there are better criteria for establishing claims to knowledge and things like that. But anyway, that's another concept.
Right. Almost down to 5 minutes. Chris?
Yes, Mike pretty well asked my question for me, so I'll slightly rephrase it. Can truth ever be binary? And I'm thinking particularly when we've been discussing it in legal terms, as some of the speakers have been. So is there ever a clear value to truth?
Right. Would you like to answer?
Yes, when you put something on a balance, justice, one side is either heavier than the other or it isn't. Mind you, it depends how accurate the scales are.
So that's a no then.
This is sort of rather tentative, but towards the end of my paper, I said something. I was struggling with this problem of negative truths, and I began, well, let me just launch a simple theory. Truth is not bivalent. Truth is monovalent. There is only one truth value, and that is true. False is a deceptive just hold-all for failures, all sorts of failures to be truth, but false isn't a truth value. The reason I'm saying that is because I can then get a much better account of truth makers, a more coherent picture, in which you don't have to go around finding false makers all the time. You have truth makers and truths, and then the falsehoods are just all the stuff that falls off the table at the end, I'm thinking that that's the way to go. So I'm thinking there's no such thing as falsehood. There's only truth or failure of truth.
Richard Feynman, the physicist, said of scientific truth, he said, well, the fact is we know what's wrong, what's false, but we don't know what actually is the case with certainty. So we can know falsities with certainty, but we can't know truths with certainty, at least in the context of science.
I think I mentioned this yesterday. I don't think of truth as bivalent. I think any more than heat, things are not either hot or cold. They have more or less heat in them, and propositions have more or less truth in them, and that evaluation turns upon context and so on, but I don't believe in anything like an absolute, uncontextual truth, possibly an uncontextual falsity, like zero.
I really don't know how to answer this question. I'm sort of puzzling away here. In clear-cut cases, you can have an either-or, but I'm just thinking about all the fuzzy ones. I want to think about this before I answer.
There are clear-cut cases.
Yeah, you've got to have a notion of a clear-cut case before you can kind of
In which case you've done the job.
I agree what Peter said, that there are truths and then there are errors. And I think, as I said, there's truths about the states and affairs of the world that Peter is sitting next to me alone. And I also suggested that we have truths of our own sort of mental propositions. Now, I know that's going to get me into very controversial territory, and Ben brought up the point yesterday about, well, can we actually know, sort of, the implication was, can we actually know what's going on in our mind? And that's where I think you need a bit of methodology to go behind it on the handouts I gave out yesterday. I put out that Descartes methodology. And I think when you utilise that, then you get rid of the errors, and then you come to truth. So in that way, I can say that I can know my intentions, that I have a true intention. I have carried out what I intended to do, or I have been in error. So say, for example, I fall over. I could have intended to fall over because maybe I'm acting. Or I could have fallen over accidentally. Now, I know the truth of that statement, so that gives it that sort of truth preservation, there's that truth marker in it, and this is where I do think we need to put the epistemology in with it.
No, well, you see, I think you're completely conflating certainty and truth.
Yeah.
And this is what Descartes was aiming for. Descartes was striving after certainty, which is a totally epistemological notion, whereas I do regard truth really as an ontological notion, and I do not think you can separate them. I know this house is totally divided on that one, right. But no, I do disagree profoundly with what you said, or at least with what...
Thank you. Come back. Well, I've got six more questions to go, I'm afraid. In the bar afterwards.
I think we'll just have to go to the bar.
Or in the ring afterwards. Anne, it's your turn.
Oh, yes.
Nice quick one, please.
Quick as I can. Question to Peter.
Peter is sitting next to her,
or
Peter is not
sitting here. Well, I'm just saying, passing to Peter, if you think ontology and epistemology are separate, that means that you think that you're outside the world.
No, it doesn't.
Right, so this Peter.
Wrong.
So this Peter. I found your talk absolutely riveting, I must say. I didn't take a single note. I sat there and I hang on to every word. And one of the thoughts that went through my head was reading, so it's a long time ago, you can hear, I.A. Richards on literary criticism thing. And he was arguing that you can tell whether a poet has written a good poem or not by the rhythm. It's the rhythm that gives it away. You know, a scholastic, somebody who just knows that this is what you do with a poem, it has these number of meters, the rhythm won't be right. And when I read it, I thought, that really does sound right to me. And the poems flow through my head, yeah. But then I thought, well, if a scientist was to make a statement like, it's the rhythm that gives away whether a poem is, you know, really felt or just a piece of scholastic exercise, that scientist would have to actually justify the claim in some way. Would have to say why he was arguing that, and that's how I turned over the pages of Richards to find where the argument was, and it wasn't. Now, the thing that really riveted me about, so you might comment on that, but was your talk about ideology, and that's because at the moment I'm trying to write something myself about ideology. And at first I thought, when I heard you, I thought I'm going to have to alter the whole thing of it. Because you said that fictions are overt, yes, and therefore not dangerous, whereas ideologies are covert and therefore dangerous. Now, what I've tried to write myself is to say that the most successful ideologies of the lot are totally unconscious to everybody. There isn't somebody who is covering them up in the covert sense. It's just that the whole human race has got it wrong. And that is, to me, the most powerful ideology of the lot. So is that what you meant?
It's indeed. I mean, a covert fiction doesn't follow that somebody has covered it up or somebody has invented it consciously and decided, although in the case of, shall we say, most of the Bible, which was actually consciously invented by people who were trying to account for what they'd heard and traditions and all sorts of things that were going on. So, most religious documents are conscious attempts to account for stuff that's in the world, like a lot of philosophy actually. It's not consciously covert, but when people accept it and then stop questioning it, that's where it becomes covert fiction, because fiction is always questionable. Covert. In the case, I was going to give an example about rhythm, too. An example, an argument for the idea of rhythm being important would be an analogy with the scientific concept of an elegant theory. Elegance in a theory is really quite hard to define. It's partly to do with simplicity, partly to do with power, and partly to do with the way it's expressed, in all sorts of the way it fits with the examples and so on, the way it can be falsified or not falsified. There are lots of criteria for analysing elegance. But elegance, I would make analogous with rhythm. On the other hand, it was pretty again the slidey toes, Gidgar and Gimbal in the way, is absolutely rhythmic, wonderfully rhythmic, but it doesn't make any sense. It's neither true nor false. But I would say that a poet with a good sense of rhythm, and it might be quite subtle, is more to be trusted than one that is almost linear.
So
would
I, but
right.
No
other.
Can I just say something very quick? I do think there is an analogy for scientists, which is that a hypothesis has to have something like poetic rhythm in order for them to think it's worth pursuing.
Yeah. Right. Anyone else got anything to contribute before we go on? It's actually time for that question. Good.
Hugh had actually, I thought he was going to ask my question, but he didn't. In the end, he seemed to be a little bit diverted about the nature of truth itself. What I was going to ask him, what I expected to be addressed here, is that we are fundamentally intending to tell truth as a linguistic community. It would make no sense to say that, you know, to tell fibs, because then you would have the creeping liar paradox all the time, and you would not be able to pass on any information whatsoever, it seems to me. So how do you feel about, I think, intentionality towards some kind of, like not being truth, and the total truth, but there's always a call. And this is where the myths come in, because they seem to have the core of a truth, which may be ancient, but which has changed as we articulate our own understandings. And the negative truth was what I was interested in.
Yes, but you don't need to say very much more. The idea of a language which is either intended to or in fact does tell untruths is nonsense. It doesn't make sense at all. So your thesis is proved.
And that is the point that Morty and Davis are making about radical interpretation, is that you have to extend the principle of charity that language encapsulates truth, but in that sort of limited sense. You're disagreeing with me there, I would say.
Language evolves.
That's their argument there, is that makes truth a very limited thing. It doesn't make it this big sort of objective reality, philosophical, platonic sort of notion that causes the metaphysical confusion in the philosophy, I suspect. So it takes truth into a different functional area.
I think somebody from the audience said it, but language has given us to conceal our thoughts.
I think I agree with that. I agree with you, Verna. I agree with your first statement that we apply the principle of charity to people who are giving us information. We have lie detectors in the shape of sort of reading body language, and so it's clearly very important to us that when we're not trying to deceive, and the very notion of deception implies its opposite, it clearly is essential. We know that.
I'm struggling to make sense of the idea that language has actually evolved in order to tell lies and deceive people. Why would anyone ever listen to anything if we all knew that it was just there in order to tell lies? It seems to be obvious it starts with truth, and that the lying is an early parasite. It's rather like free riders on the train, free riders in sort of deontological ethics, you know, that they're parasitic on the fact that goodness is going on, so they can sponge off it. And I would have thought lying was like that myself.
You said lying, you said language
is involved. Can I just say, Robin,
he sort of agreed. Yeah, I think it's more probable that the parasitic theory is right, but I think there's also the point that you make, which is there must be some truth in it, because if we didn't have that, we wouldn't be able to communicate. So we can distinguish some ways between truth and error. So I think in that sense that it is right, but that's where I think that we need to account for self-interest and get beyond that. And that's why I think the truth is something else apart from just the statements, because of the way in which we can utilise our statements.
Just very quickly, we can't distinguish between ourselves and our parasites. We depend entirely on our parasites.
The next parasite, the next question.
We've heard about the importance of truth and why is truth important? What equity is? And it strikes me that one reason that truth is important is you might have to confront truths that you'd rather not. Relativism is never having to say you're wrong. Al Gore talks about an inconvenient truth. Climate change is a truth that maybe we have to confront. We might not like it, I don't like it, but our own actions might have to be held up to some sort of moral scrutiny if we look at them from an objective rather than a sort of self-serving point of view. Or we might have some dearly held beliefs about public policy, but then find there's some evidence that actually things don't quite work in the way that we thought they did. So I suppose if we do have to confront some comfortable truths, it might help us become better citizens or live better. But as philosophers, some of the things we're debating about, what philosophical position you come to, perhaps doesn't have those sorts of consequences. I was wondering whether the panel think that having true beliefs is somehow something that we have a moral responsibility to do in itself. Is it just important to have true beliefs where there's a possibility of you causing harm or not doing good? Or is somehow trying to clear out your mind of its false beliefs somehow a good thing to do? Bearing in mind that some psychologists think that having an over-optimistic view of life, for instance, is conducive to mental health.
Right.
Thank you very much for that, Rebecca. Now, in the first things that you were saying, I think that's absolutely correct, that there are numerous advantages to denying the truth. And I suspect that's why we come up with all these explanations that allow us to almost explain away truth. We can construct these wonderful arguments that allow us to think that truth isn't something that we need to worry about in any way because it's not real. So that's what I suspect philosophers have done. We've come up with these sort of human construct theories. We've come up with thinking about truth just in contextualized states. With your second point, I think virtually everybody would agree, I think, that having true beliefs is a good thing in itself, something that we should all aspire to, even though we might have, for self-interest reason, not want to go towards those true beliefs.
I would say that lots of things are very good for mental health in a very short term and in a very limited context. Optimism as being a quality of mental health, I regard as a very limited way of looking at mental health. I think a hopeless optimist might think he's very healthy, but might objectively be thought to be incredibly unhealthy. I think drugs, for some people, are a source of mental health. I mean, if you're perpetually under a haze of heroin, you probably feel extremely mentally healthy, but objectively would not be thought to be healthy. And I think this is a definition of what we ultimately mean by an ultimate sense of... I think if we take this negative view of truth, if we say that truth is what the way the world is, and the way the world is truth, that's a circular argument. But it does mean that it's an entirety, it's a whole. And if you take our bits like optimism or drugs or ideologies, they are taking bits of it out and examining them in isolation, whereas the world is a whole.
I don't know,
sorry.
I'm sort of struggling with this one. I'm sort of thinking very fast and I'm halfway through it. I just thought it was a really interesting question. I'm thinking it in terms of the virtues, and I'm now dividing it between the social virtues that involve truth and the intellectual virtues that involve truth. I'm thinking there's an intellectual virtue of trying to get your beliefs correct. But, I mean, I'm thinking of a person I used to know who seemed to live for a long time with a blatant delusion, and I find it very hard to morally criticize that. You know, it sort of got this person through the situation they were in, and I could only say good luck to you. So it doesn't seem a terrible crime to sort of try to aspire to high levels of truth in your own belief. But the virtue of sincerity seems to me to be an obvious social virtue, and you know, to try and speak truth and not lie and all the rest of it. So I'm inclined to think that it's of more importance than the social virtues, but I would certainly defend it as an intellectual virtue as well.
I think this raises the great difference between truths and values. People may or may not set a value on the truth, and if they set a value on the truth, it may or may not be because of a value that they assign to something else, like the future of the human race or global warming or whatever. But it's all value to value. You could ask an empirical question, how many people hold this value? As you could ask the empirical question, how many people prefer coffee ice cream or have the low and vulgar taste of strawberry ice cream? But what you can't do is to show that either of them is a better value to hold.
Okay. Two bits to Rebecca's question, really. There's the question of thinking about an uncomfortable truth, right? That there is a situation, there is a state of affairs, let's say. And it's something that that a lot of people don't know about. The question that then arises is a moral one. There might be some in certain situations it might be preferable to just keep quiet, like if somebody, but in others it's clearly in the public interest to reveal the truth. So you probably need some kind of a moral theory when if you're sure you have discovered the truth. I don't like using that word. Discovering the truth about an uncomfortable situation. You then need to think what you're going to do about it, and you really need to decide what the consequences will be if you do the one thing or the other.
Right, thank you. I'm going to stop that question. We've got the two last two questions reduced to 4 minutes now. The last two of the original people on my list. Frank.
Coming back to Simon, I liked Sutton Ross's aversion to theories of truth because it supports an aversion I have to conceptual analysis. Because as I see it, philosophers who try and find out what knowledge is or what truth is, are sort of building in the sky a kind of platonic ideal of something as though it exists out there, which is something I completely disagree with. And so you get a theory of knowledge being set up, and then Mr. Gettier comes along and shifts it. Everyone was happy with justified true belief, and he said, no, that doesn't work. And then he shows very cleverly why it doesn't work, and you get 150,000 PhDs written on all the alternatives that get the edge up. And I think it's the same with truth. And this is why I think I could achieve a reconciliation between Peter Gibson's and the Rorty thing. Because Peter, you said that as far as you're concerned, you weren't too bothered what truth was. You were happy to treat it as primitive. Other people were talking, saying that the truth makers were primitives. That's not what you said at all.
No, that's right. Truth is the primitive, yeah. not the truth
maker. Which is what brought in Davidson's say, because Davidson is particularly concerned to do away with skin content distinction, which is just another way of phrasing the subject-object distinction, and bringing epistemology and ontology into the world in a sort of monist sort of way, you know. That's how I read it. I mean, there are different interpretations of it. So I didn't think there was that much difference. And I think the notions that where Peter gets uncomfortable about relativism or this idea of losing truth, I get feeling get uncomfortable about it, that losing truth leaves us open to relativism, actually sort of depends on this Platonic difficulty that stems, I think, from Theaetetus and the work of Protagoras' dream there. But that's another conversation. But I think I'm trying to get back to where you were. I think there isn't that much distinction between the two. There are just some little things that need tidying up. Yeah.
Well,
you
there's one final question, one final question on my original list, which is all we have time for, which is Hannah.
Thank you. I'm sorry to butt into drinking time. I found a good draw. Fiction, the notion of fiction, which we brought in because fiction contrasts with truth in its primary meaning, seems to me to be spread far too wide. Fictional truth is a special case. We've talked about it. But in general, statements, if you say a statement that it is fiction, you are entailing that it is not literally true. So a statement like money is a fiction seems to entail that statements about money are not literally true. And that's just wrong. And that is interesting about truth makers, because the statements about money are statements about a construct, a legal, social, cultural construct, rather than a tangible thing. And so the truth makers, if you believe in them, are simply reflections of the criteria we have to settle questions about money. That's why I prefer truth conditions, because there are all kinds of concepts and that doesn't make them all fictions.
I absolutely agree. I'm very keen on truth conditions as a thing from truth makers. I regard truth makers as a particular case of truth conditions. In the case of money, for example, if you look up money in anywhere, the amount of money in the system is measured in about four different ways, I think, M1, 2, 3, and 4. And you would have to put a condition that you were talking about M3 or M2 rather than about M1. And for your statement about money in that particular case to be true or false. So I think all statements, all utterances, are conditionally true. They're true caterus paribus, they're true either contextually, they're never absolutely true. Above all, they never tell the whole truth. They're always partial in two senses, that they're only part of the truth, and that they're told from a particular partial point of view. They may also be partial in that they're motivated. They usually are motivated. People only make a statement in order to inform somebody or to fill in a gap in general knowledge or to... You say different things on the phone from the things you say face to face. So you don't say, I'm sitting down, if you're face to face with somebody, only if you're on the phone. And so on. So, yes, truth conditions work very well across a large range of areas.
I don't understand what this truth is that we're under martial law. That's the
problem.
Sorry. I just want to come back to this truth conditions versus truth maker thing. As far as I'm concerned, these two gentlemen are sort of suggesting I prefer the one to the other, but they're not in competition as far as I'm concerned. In the normal usage, in Davidson, for example, truth conditions is a theory of meaning. And the simple point to make is that a complete falsehood can have truth conditions, because it just tells you what it means. So if I say there are a million people in this room, the meaning of that is the conditions under that which are true, and it's completely false. So there is no truth maker that there are a million people in this room, but there are truth conditions, and that in my understanding of the term truth conditions, they're just entirely separate things that are not in competition. But there may be a different notion of truth conditions going around here.
I totally agree with the questioner. Money is not a fiction. And by the way, I don't agree either that it's depends on this or that. Money is anything generally exchangeable for goods and services, and that definition works just as long as you have context. In some contexts, like prison, it may be drugs or cigarettes, but it's still a perfectly acceptable definition which will work anywhere, and there's nothing fictional about it any more than there is about the social constructs of family, government, or law.
I'm supporting what Peter said about truth conditions and truth makers. Totally compatible. Both should be accepted.
Well, yes, I very quickly say that the idea of truth conditions having nothing to do with truth, being able to be absolutely false, sounds to me like a bit of an oxymoron.
Before we stop, can I invite a round of applause for Eileen?
Oh, no,